Rhaeda said. Oh, sorry.
Are you dizzy?
No, not at all. Just thinking. Aunt laughed.
That's no good, Ma. You know better.
Aunt stood up. He was all knobs and sticks, this boy who had just turned 9, with elbows and knees and feet that were all too big for his skinny limbs. In the past few months, he'd found friends and begun to act like a boy again. He refused to have his hair cut, hated any sort of games, and called her Ma.
Guess what today is? Elsa said.
What?
Lareda said, not bothering to look up.
We get state relief, Elsa said. Real cash money. I can start paying down our debt.
Sure,
Lareda said, plunging her empty plate into the bucket of soapy water.
We registered with the state a year ago, Elsa said. We can get aid as residents now.
Lareda looked at her.
They'll find a way to take it back.
Come on, Miss Sunshine, Elsa said, offering Aunt his coat. Elsa didn't bother with her own coat. She put on her galoshes and wrapped a blanket around her shoulders. They stepped out into the busy camp. Now that the threat of frost had passed, men were busy in the fields. Tractors worked ceaselessly, readying the soil, churning it up, planting seeds.
It makes me think of Grandpa,
Lareda said. They all stopped, listened to the sound of the tractor's motors. The smell of freshly turned soil hung in the air.
It does, Elsa said, feeling a wave of homesickness.
They kept walking, 3 abreast, until they reached the school tents.
Bye, Ma. Good luck with relief,
Aunt said, running off. Lareda ducked into her tent. Elsa stood there a moment, listening to the sounds of children talking and laughing, of teachers telling them to take their seats. If she closed her eyes, which she did, just for a moment, she could imagine a whole different world. Finally, she turned away. Paths between the tents and cabins had been worn into ruts by hundreds of feet. At the bathrooms, she got in line and waited her turn. It wasn't a bad wait at this time of day, less than 20 minutes for the toilets. She wanted to take a shower, but with only 2 showers, the wait was always an hour or more. She went into her cabin and washed the breakfast dishes and put them in the salvaged apple crate that was their cupboard. In the past month since the flood, they had become good at scavenging. She made her bed and put on her coat and left the cabin. In town, a long line of sad-looking men and women snaked in front of the state relief office. Most didn't look up from their own clasped hands. They were Midwesterners, or Texans, or Southerners, most of them. Proud people who weren't used to being on the dole. Elsa took her place at the back. People moved in behind her quickly, seemed to come from the 4 corners of town to get in line.
Are you okay, ma'am?
She gave herself a little shake, forced a smile.
I forgot to eat, I guess. I'm fine. Thank you.
The scrawny young man in front of her wore dungarees that must have been bought when he weighed 50 pounds more. He needed a shave, but his eyes were kind.
We all forgot that, he said with a smile. I ain't eaten since Thursday. What day is it?
Monday.
He shrugged. Kids, you know.
I know.
You got relief before?
She shook her head.
I didn't qualify until today.
Qualify?
You have to be in the state a year to get relief.
A year? We could be dead by then.
He sighed and stepped out of the line and walked away.
Wait, Elsa called out. You need to register now.
The young man didn't turn around, and Elsa couldn't step out of line to follow him. Losing her place would cost her hours. She eventually made her way to the front. Once there, she looked down at the bright-faced young woman seated at the desk with a portable typewriter in front of her. Beside it was a long index card box.
Name?
Elsa Martinelli. I have 2 children, Anthony and Lareda. I registered last year on this date.
The woman rifled through the red cards, pulled one out.
Here you are. Address?
Welty Growers Camp.
The woman put the card in the typewriter and added the information.
All right, Mrs. Martinelli, three people in the family, you'll get $13.50 per month. She pulled the card out of the typewriter. Thank you. Elsa rolled the bills into as small a cylinder as she could and tightened her fist around them. As she left the state relief office, she noticed a commotion down the street at the federal relief office. A crowd of people were shouting. Elsa walked cautiously toward the melee, keenly aware of the money in her hand. She stopped beside a man at the edge of the crowd. What's going on?
The feds cut relief. No more commodities.
Someone in the crowd yelled, That ain't right! A rock sailed through the relief office window, breaking the glass. The mob surged toward the office, shouting. Within minutes, a siren could be heard. A police car rolled up, lights flashing. Two uniformed men jumped out holding billy clubs.
Who wants to go to jail for vagrancy?
One of the policemen grabbed a raggedly dressed man, hauled him over to the police car, and shoved him in.
Anyone else want to go to jail?
Elsa turned to the man beside her. How can they just end the commodities relief? Don't they care about us? The man gave her a disbelieving look.
You trying to be funny?
After leaving the relief office, Elsa walked to the ditch bank camp on Sutter Road. In the months since the flood, more people had moved on to this land. Old-timers pitched their tents and parked their cars and built their shacks on higher ground, if they could find it. Newcomers set up near the ditch. The ground was studded with spring grass and old belongings, some of which poked up here and there in the dirt. A pipe edge, a book, a ruined lantern. Most things of value had been dug up already, or were buried too deeply to be found. She came to the Dewey's truck. They'd built a shack around it with scavenged wood and tar paper and scrap metal. She found Jean sitting in a chair beside the truck's front fender. Mary and Lucy sat in the grass beside her, cross-legged, poking sticks into the ground.
Elsa, Jean said, starting to rise.
Don't get up, Elsa said, seeing how pale her friend was, how gaunt. Elsa sat down on the overturned bucket beside Jean.
I don't have any coffee to offer you, Jean said. I'm drinking hot water.
I could use a cup, Elsa said. Jean poured Elsa a cup of boiling water and handed it to her.
The feds cut relief, Elsa said. People are rioting in town.
Jean coughed.
I heard. Don't know how we're gonna make it till cotton.
We'll make it. Elsa opened her hand slowly, looked down at the $13.50 she had to feed her family until next month. She peeled off two $1 bills and handed them to Jean.
I can't take that, Jean said. Not money.
Of course you can. They both knew that the $27 the Deweys got from the state wasn't nearly enough to feed six people, and Elsa could get things on credit from the store. The Deweys couldn't. Jean reached for the bills, trying to smile.
Well, I am saving up for our bottle of gin.
You bet.
We will get rip-roaring drunk real soon. Bad girl drunk, Elsa said, smiling at the thought. I was only a bad girl once in my life, and you know what it got me?
What?
A bad husband and a beautiful new family. So I say we be bad. That a promise?
You bet.
Someday soon, Jean.
Elsa walked back to Welty Farms and went to the company store. On the way home from the relief office, she had made calculations in her head. If she used half of her relief money to pay down her debt each month, it would be tight, but they'd have a chance. In the store, she picked out a loaf of bread and one of bologna and a can of chipped beef, some hot dogs, and a bag of potatoes. A jar of peanut butter, a bar of soap, several cans of milk, and some lard. More than anything, she wanted to add a dozen eggs and a Hershey's candy bar, but that was how people were ruined by credit. She placed her items on the counter. Harold smiled at her as he rang up the items. Relief day, eh, Mrs. Martinelli? I can tell by your smile.
It's a relief for sure.
The cash register clattered and rang.
That'll be $2.39.
That sure is steep, Elsa said.
Yep, he said, giving her a commiserating look.
She withdrew the cash from her pocket, began counting it out.
Oh, we don't take cash, Mrs., just credit.
But I have money, finally. I wanted to pay on my bill, too.
It doesn't work that way. Credit only. I can even give you a little spending money, on credit, with interest, for gas and such.
But how do I get out from my debt?
You pick.
The reality of the situation sank in. Why hadn't Elsa figured it out before? Welty wanted her in their debt, wanted her to spend her relief money lavishly and be broke again next winter. Of course they'd give you cash for credit, probably at a high interest rate, because poor folks worked for less, asked for less. All she could do was try to use her relief money to buy goods in town at lower prices to offset her accruing debt at the company store, but it wouldn't make much of a dent. They couldn't live on $13 a month. She reached into the basket and removed a can of chipped beef, which she set back on the counter.
I can't afford this.
He recalculated her credit total, wrote it down.
Sorry, ma'am.
Are you? What about going north to pick peaches? I suppose I'd have to pay for the cabin in advance while I'm gone.
Oh, no, ma'am. You'd have to give up the cabin and the sure thing job of picking cotton.
We can't follow the crops.
Elsa stood there a moment, staring at him, wondering how he could stand to be a part of this system. They couldn't follow the crops and keep the cabin, which meant they had to stay here without work, waiting for cotton, living on relief and credit.
So are slaves.
Workers. The lucky ones, I'd say.
Would you?
Have you seen the way folks live out by the ditch bank?
Yes, Elsa said. I've seen it.
Holding her bag of groceries, she walked out of the store. Outside, people milled about, women hanging laundry, men scavenging for wood, young children looking for any bit of junk to call a toy. A dozen stoop-shouldered women in baggy dresses stood in line for the two women's toilets. There were more than 300 people living here now. They'd pitched 15 new tents on concrete pads. She looked at the women, really looked. Gray, slanted shoulders, kerchiefs on untended hair, drab dresses mended and remended, fallen stockings, worn shoes, thin. Still, they smiled at one another in line, talked, wrangled their runaway children, those young enough not to be in school. Elsa had stood in that line enough to know that the women talked about ordinary things, gossip, children, health. Life went on, even in the hardest of times. 29. In May, the valley dried out beneath sunny days and everything grew and blossomed. In June, the cotton plants flowered and needed to be trimmed. True to Welty's word, those who lived at Welty Farms Growers Camp were the first to get these precious jobs. Elsa spent hours working beneath the hot sun. Most of the valley's ditch bank residents, including Jeb and the boys, had hitchhiked north for work. Jean stayed back with the girls and the stuck-in-the-ground truck that was all they had left. Today, just before dawn, a big truck pulled into the Welty camp, chugging smoke. The people standing in line barely waited for it to stop before they climbed aboard. Men and women got into the back and crammed in tightly, hats drawn low, gloves on, gloves they'd had to purchase at the company store for an exorbitant price. Loretta looked up at Mom, who was pressed close to the wooden slats directly behind the cab. She had been the second person in line when the truck pulled up this morning.
Make sure Aunt does his homework, Mom said. Are you sure I can't?
I'm sure, Loretta. You can pick cotton when it's ready, that's it. Now go to school and learn something so you don't end up like me. I'm 40, and most days I feel 100. Besides, there's only a week of school left anyway.
A man closed the gate at the back of the truck. Within moments, the truck was chugging out to the road, heading to the cotton fields. It wasn't hot yet, but it soon would be. Loretta went back into the cabin. Already, the small interior had begun to grow warm. Though she knew it was a harbinger of summer heat to come, Loretta still appreciated the warmth after the cold of winter. She opened the air vents and went to the hot plate and started the oatmeal she and Aunt would have for breakfast. As light came into the cabin, Aunt stumbled out of bed and walked to the door.
I gotta pee.
He came back 15 minutes later, scratching his privates.
Did Mom get work?
She did.
He sat on a wooden crate at the table they'd scavenged. After they finished eating, Loretta walked Aunt to school.
I'll meet you at the cabin after school, she said. Don't dawdle, today's laundry.
It'll be hot.
Aunt grimaced and went into his classroom. Loretta headed to her own classroom. As she reached the tent flap, she heard Mrs. Sharp say,
Today the girls are going to learn to mix cosmetics, and the boys will do a science project.
Loretta groaned. Making cosmetics.
We all know how important beauty is in finding a man, Mrs. Sharp said.
No,
Loretta said aloud.
Just no.
She put her foot down on making cosmetics. Last week, the girls had spent hours learning to sift dry ingredients and knead bread, while the boys had been taught how to fly in a replicated plywood airplane cockpit with painted-on instruments. She didn't skip school often, because she knew how much her mother cared about education, but honestly, sometimes Loretta just couldn't stand it. And Lord knew Mrs. Sharp would give Loretta the evil eye either way. Her questions in class were not appreciated. She ducked into their cabin, found her latest library book, and headed out of camp. Out on the main road, she felt her spine straightening, her chin lifting. She swung her arms as she walked to town. What could be better than skipping school to visit the library? She'd read the Communist Manifesto this week, and she was eager to find something equally enlightening. Mrs. Quistorff had mentioned something by a man named Hobbes. Main Street was busy today. Men in suits and women in spring dresses walked toward the movie theater. The marquee read, Town Meeting. Loretta walked into the library and headed straight for the checkout desk. She handed Mrs. Quistorff the book.
And what did we learn from this?
Mrs. Quistorff asked in a lowered voice, although it didn't look like anyone else was here. The library was empty most days.
It's all about class struggle, isn't it? Serfs against landlords throughout history. Marx and Engels are right. If there was only one class where everyone worked for the good of all, it would be a better world. We wouldn't have people like the big growers making all the money and people like us doing all the work. We starve while the rich get richer.
From each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, Mrs. Quistorff said, nodding. That's the general idea. Who's to say if it actually works, though?
Hey, what's going on at the theater? I thought it was closed down.
Mrs. Quistorff looked back through the windows.
Town meeting. It's politics, I guess you could say, happening right under our noses.
Would they let me in?
It's open to the public, but, well, sometimes it's better to study politics from a nice, safe, historical perspective. The real thing can be pretty ugly.
How can they stop me from going? I'm a resident of the state now.
Yes, but, well, be careful.
I'm reliably careful, Mrs. Q,
Loretta said. Outside, a hot June sun shone down. She left the side street and emerged onto Main, passing a soup kitchen with a long line of people out front. Loretta merged into the well-dressed crowd and entered the theater. Inside, red velvet curtains bracketed a raised stage. Gilt trim highlighted intricately carved woodwork. Within minutes, most of the seats were taken. Loretta took a seat on the aisle beside a man in a black suit and hat who was smoking a cigar. The smell of the smoke made her feel slightly sick.
A man stepped up onto the stage, took his place behind the podium. The crowd quieted.
Thank you all for coming. We all know why we're here. In 1933, the Federal Emergency Relief Administration was set up to be temporary help for folks coming into the state. We didn't know we'd be overrun with migrants. And who knew so many of them would be of weak moral character? Who knew they'd want to live on relief? Thanks to FDR's support for business, we've ended federal relief, but the state still pays people who have been here for a year, and frankly, the state just doesn't have the resources to handle the need.
Weak moral character? A man in the crowd stood up.
We hear they aren't going to pick. Why should they? They're living the good life on the dole, from my taxes.
What if there aren't enough workers to pick our cotton crop?
And what about that darn tent camp the feds are building for migrants in Arvin? It'll be a hotbed for agitators. I hear they're talking about giving them gosh darn health care.
A man stood. Laredo recognized Mr. Welty. He liked to walk through camp with his chest all puffed up and look down on his workers.
The damn relief workers are coddling the Okies, Welty said. I say we stop all relief during the picking season. What if they get a hankering to unionize? We can't afford a strike.
Strike. The man at the podium held out his hands to quiet the audience.
That's why we're here today. The CSA shares your concerns. We will not let the crop or your bottom line suffer. The state knows how important the crop is to our economy, just as we know how important it is to manage the disease in the camps so our own children remain safe. We need to build a migrant school, a migrant hospital, keep them to themselves.
The damn red agitators were at my farm this week stirring up trouble. We gotta stop a strike before it happens.
A man strode down the aisle as if he owned the place. He wore a brown suit coat that was dusty and out of date. Loretta saw him and sat up straighter. Jack.
They're Americans, Jack said. Do you have no shame at all? You don't mind breaking their backs when the cotton is ready, but as soon as it's done, you throw them away like they're garbage, just as you've always done to the people who pick your crops. Money, money, money. It's all you care about.
A shouting match erupted throughout the audience. Men stood, shouted, pumped their fists in anger.
A man can't feed his family on 1 cent for every pound of cotton he picks. You know it, and you're scared. You should be scared. You kick a dog long enough, he's going to bite, Jack said.
Two policemen rushed in. One of them grabbed Jack and hauled him away. Loretta ran outside, blinking for a moment in the brightness. Flyers stuck to the sidewalk, along the curb, drifted down the street. Workers unite for change. Jack lay sprawled on the ground. His hat had fallen off and lay beside him.
Jack!
Loretta yelled, running over to him, kneeling.
Loretta.
He grabbed his hat, crushed it to his head, and stood up, giving her a slow-building smile.
My little commie in training, how the hell are you?
How could he smile with blood running down from a cut at his temple? A police siren wailed.
Come on, Jack said, taking her by the arm. I've had enough jail time this week.
He gathered up his flyers and then pulled her across the street and into a diner. Loretta climbed up onto the stool next to him. Taking a napkin, she dabbed at the blood at his temple.
Does it give me a rakish look?
That's not funny, she said.
No, it's not.
What was all of that about?
He ordered Loretta a chocolate milkshake.
Cotton prices are down. That's bad for the industry and bad news for the workers. The growers are getting nervous.
Loretta slurped up the sweet, creamy milkshake so fast it gave her a headache.
That's why they had that meeting and called us names?
They call you names because they don't want to think of you as like them. They're worried about you forming unions, demanding more money. The so-called bum blockade, the closing of state borders, is over, so migrants are pouring into the state again.
They don't want to pay us enough to live on.
Exactly.
How do we make them pay?
You'll have to fight for it.
He paused, looked at her, trying to appear nonchalant.
Now, tell me, kid, how's your mom?
After 10 hours of hard labor beneath a hot sun, Elsa climbed down from the truck. She had her work chit in one gloved hand. It wasn't worth much, but it was something. The company store charged the camp residents 10% to convert the chit to credit, but they couldn't cash it anywhere else. If they wanted cash instead of credit, they had to pay interest. So, in point of fact, as little as they were paid, it was really even 10% less. Exhausted, her hands and shoulders aching in pain, she walked over to the store and went inside. The bell that jangled at her entrance grated on her nerves. All she could think about in this place was her growing debt and the grinding truth that there was no way out of it. A new man was at the counter, someone she didn't know. "Cabin 10," she said. The new man opened the book, looked at the chit, and wrote down the amount she'd earned. Turning, she chose 2 cans of milk from the aisle beside her. She hated to pay what they charged for it, but Aunt and Loretta needed milk to keep their bones strong.
"Put this on my bill," she said, without looking back.
She joined the women in line for the bathroom. Usually, she struck up a conversation with the women around her, but after 10 hours in the cotton field, she didn't have the energy. When it was finally her turn, she went into the dark, smelly bathroom and used the toilet. She washed her hands at a pump outside and then headed back to her cabin. A foreman followed her part of the way, stopped to listen to a pair of men talking along the fence line. It was happening more and more lately, the growers sending spies to listen to what the workers said when they weren't in the fields. At her cabin door, she paused, collected herself, and managed a smile just as she opened the door.
"Hello, Explorer."
She stopped. Jack sat on Elsa's bed, hunched forward, as if telling a story to Aunt, who sat on the concrete floor in front of him, cross-legged, looking rapt.
"Ma!"
Aunt said, springing up.
"Jack is telling us about Hollywood. He's met a bunch of movie stars. Ain't that right, Jack?"
Elsa saw the stack of flyers on the chair beside her. "Workers Unite for Change." Jack stood.
"I met Loretta in town today. She invited me here."
Elsa looked at Loretta, who had the grace to blush.
"Loretta was in town, on a school day. How interesting. And she invited you, a communist, back to our tent with your flyers. How very thoughtful of her."
"I skipped school and went to the library," Loretta said, as Elsa put the milk away. "Mrs. Sharp was teaching the girls in class how to make cosmetics, Mom. I mean, we can't buy books, and we're hungry, and making eyeliner is important."
"Loretta tells me you've been working hard lately," Jack said, coming toward her. "It was sure hot today."
"It's still hot, and I'm lucky to have the work," she said.
When he was close enough to hear her whisper, she said,
"You endanger us with your presence."
"I promised the kids an adventure,"
he whispered back.
"Aunt tells me you have an explorers club. May I join?"
"Please, Mom,"
the kids said in unison.
"They have the hearing of jackals when they want to," Elsa said.
"Please!"
"Okay, okay, but I should feed us."
"No," Jack said. "You are in my care now. I'll meet you out at the road. My truck's there. It's best not to be seen with me."
"I'm pretty sure it's best not to be with you," Elsa said.
Loretta jumped up and led Jack to the door, closing it behind him. Slowly, she turned, making a face.
"About school?"
Honestly, Elsa was too hot and tired to care about skipped school right now. She washed and dried her face and brushed her hair.
"We'll talk about it tomorrow."
She made Aunt turn around, then stripped out of her work clothes and into the pretty cotton dress from the Salvation Army. They left the cabin and walked out to the main road where Jack's truck was parked. All the way there, she worried that they were being watched, but she didn't see any foremen skulking about. They crammed into Jack's old truck. Elsa held Aunt on her lap.
"And we're off,"
Aunt said, as Jack steered their way out to the road. Soon, they turned onto the road where the abandoned hotel was.
Wait here.
He parked the truck and bounded out and went into a small Mexican restaurant that appeared to be standing room only busy inside. Moments later, he came out with a basket, which he put in the back of the truck. Well out of town, they turned onto a road Elsa had never been on before. It twisted and turned as it rose into the foothills. At last, Jack pulled over and parked at the edge of a large grassy area, alongside a dozen or so other parked cars. People walked among the newly planted trees. Children and pets ran across the grass. Elsa could see three lakes. One was dotted with people in paddle boats. People swam along the shore, laughing and splashing. Off to the left, in a copse of trees, a band played a Jimmy Rogers song. A string of concession booths had been set up along the shore. The air smelled of brown sugar and popcorn. It was like going back in time. Elsa thought of pioneer days and how she and Rose had cooked all day to be ready, how Tony had played his fiddle and everyone had danced.
It's like home, Loretta said beside her.
Elsa reached out for her daughter's hand, held it for a moment, and then let her go. The kids ran off toward the lake.
It's beautiful, Elsa said.
Jack got the basket from the back of the truck.
The WPA built it with FDR's funds. It put men to work and paid them a good wage. This is opening day.
I thought you commies hated everything in America.
Not at all, he said solemnly. We agree with the New Deal. We believe in justice and fair wages and equal opportunity for all, not just the rich. Communism is really just the new Americanism. I think it was John Ford, the director, who said that first, at one of the early meetings of the New Hollywood Anti-Nazi League.
You take it very seriously, she said.
It is serious, Elsa.
He took her arm, began strolling through the park.
But not today.
Elsa felt people looking at her, judging her worn clothes and bare legs and shoes that didn't quite fit. A tall woman in a blue crepe dress walked past, her gloved hands holding fast to her handbag. She sniffed ever so slightly as she turned her head away. Elsa stopped, feeling ashamed.
That old bag has no right to judge you. Stare her down, Jack said, and urged her to keep walking.
It was exactly the kind of thing her grandfather would have said to her. Elsa couldn't help smiling. They went to the edge of the lake and sat down in the grass. Aunt and Loretta were splashing in water up to their knees. Elsa and Jack took off their shoes. Jack set his hat aside.
You remind me of my mother, he said.
Your mother? Have I aged that much?
It's a compliment, Elsa. Believe me, she was a fierce woman.
Elsa smiled.
I'm hardly fierce, but I'll accept any compliment these days.
I often wondered how my mother did it, survived in this country a single woman who barely spoke the language with a kid and no husband. I hated how other women treated her, how her boss treated her. I don't know why I'm telling you this.
You probably think she was lonely, worried that you weren't enough. Believe me, I know lonely. And I'm sure you were the thing that saved her from it.
He was silent for a moment, studying her.
I haven't talked about her in a long time.
Elsa waited for him to go on.
I remember the sound of her laughter. For years, I've wondered what she had to laugh about. And now I see you, here, with your children. I see the way you love them. And I think I understand her a little.
Elsa felt his gaze, steady and searching on hers, as if he wanted to know her.
Come in with us, Mommy,
Aunt said, waving her over. Grateful for the distraction, Elsa broke eye contact with him and waved at her children.
You know I can't swim.
Jack got up and pulled Elsa to her feet. They were so close she could feel his breath against her lips.
No, really, she said. I can't swim.
Trust me.
He pulled her toward the water. She would have fought, but they were garnering enough looks as it was. At the shore, he picked her up and carried her into the water. Cool water slapped Elsa in the back, and then suddenly she was in the water, in his arms, staring up at the bright blue sky. I'm floating. She felt weightless, a perfect combination of sun and water, cold and hot, steady in his arms. For a magnificent moment, the world fell away, and she was somewhere else, before now or long from now, and she wasn't hungry or tired or scared or angry. She simply was. She closed her eyes and felt at peace for the first time in years. Safe. When she opened her eyes, Jack was staring down at her. He leaned down, so close she thought he might kiss her, but he whispered, "Do you know how beautiful you are?" She wanted to laugh at the obvious joke, but she couldn't make a sound, not with him staring at her. After a moment, her silence turned the moment awkward. Still, she had no idea what she should have said. He carried her back to the grassy shore and set her down and left her there, shivering and confused, both by his words and her sudden feelings for him. He returned with a serape, which he wrapped around her shoulders. Opening the basket, he called for the kids, who ran up, dripping water from their clothes. Aunt collapsed beside Elsa. She pulled him under the serape with her. Jack opened the basket and pulled out bottles of Coca-Cola and tamales filled with beans and cheese and pork and a deliciously spiced sauce. It was the best day any of them had had in years, since before the dust and the drought and the depression.
"It reminds you, doesn't it?"
Loretta said much later, when the park had emptied and the sky had darkened and the stars had come out to shine.
"Of what?"
"Home," Loretta said.
"I swear I can hear the windmill."
But it was just the water, slapping rhythmically against the shore.
"I miss it," Aunt said.
"I'm sure they miss us too," Elsa said. "We will write them tomorrow and tell them all about this wonderful day."
She looked at Jack.
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
The exchange felt oddly intimate, or maybe it was the way he looked at her, or the way his look made her feel. "You scare me," she wanted to say, but it was ridiculous. And what did it matter anyway? This was just one day, a vacation.
"And now..."
She didn't have to finish the sentence. Jack stood. So did Aunt and Loretta. He got them settled in the back of his truck and then opened the cab door for Elsa. Back to the camp. Real life. The road home was long and lonely and winding. In her head, Elsa started a dozen conversations with him, found bits and pieces to say, but in reality, she sat in silence, too confused to say much of anything. Today had felt special. But what did she know of things like that? She didn't want to humiliate herself by imagining some feeling that wasn't there. At the entrance to the Welty camp, Jack pulled off to the side of the road and parked. Elsa watched him walk through the headlight's yellow glow to open her door. She stepped out. He took her hand.
"I'm going up to Salinas soon to try to unionize the workers up there. Maybe head over to the canneries. I'll be gone a while. So..."
"Why are you telling me that?"
"I didn't want you to think I just ran off. I wouldn't do that to you."
"That's an odd thing to say to a woman you barely know."
"If you'll notice, I'm trying to change that, Elsa. I want to know you. If you'll just give me a chance."
"You scare me," she said.
"I know,"
he said, still holding her hand.
"The growers are scared. The townspeople are angry. The state is bleeding money and people are desperate. It's a volatile situation. Something's gotta give. The last time it exploded, 3 union organizers were dead. I don't want to put you in danger."
The funny thing was, Elsa hadn't meant that at all. She was afraid of him as a man, afraid of the things she felt when he looked at her, afraid of the feelings he had awakened in her.
"Aren't you a union organizer?"
she said. "I am." It made her think for the first time about the danger he was putting himself in.
"So I am not the only one who needs to be careful, am I?"
30. All that long, hot summer, Elsa and Loretta did their best to find work. They didn't dare leave the growers camp to look elsewhere and didn't want to use relief money for gas, so they stayed in Welty and found what work they could. On days when there was no work, Elsa did her chores and then walked Loretta and Aunt to the library, where Mrs. Quistorf kept them busy with books and projects. With the kids safe at the library, Elsa often walked to the ditch bank camp and sat with Jean by the muddy water or the buried-in-dirt truck and talked.
"Where is he?"
Jean said on a particularly hot day in late August. The camp smelled to high heaven in this heat, but neither one cared. They were just happy to get a little time together.
"Who?"
Elsa said, sipping the lukewarm tea Jean had made. Jean gave Elsa that look, the one they'd perfected with each other.
"You know who I mean."
"Jack," Elsa said.
"I try not to think about him."
"You need to try harder," Jean said, "or just admit he's on your mind."
"I don't have a good history with men."
"You know the thing about history, Elsa? It's over, already dead and gone.
They say people who don't heed history are doomed to repeat it."
"Who says that? I ain't never heard it. I say folks who hang on to the past miss their chance for a future."
Elsa looked at her friend.
"Come on, Jean," she said. "Look at me. I wasn't pretty in the best of times, when I was young and well-fed and clean and wore fine clothes. And now?
Ah, Elsa, you got a wrong picture of yourself."
"Even if that is true, what does a person do about it? The things your parents say and the things your husband doesn't say become a mirror, don't they? You see yourself as they see you, and no matter how far you come, you bring that mirror with you."
"Break it," Jean said.
"How?"
"With a gosh dang rock."
Jean leaned forward.
"I'm a mirror too, Elsa. You remember that."
Cotton's ready. Word spread through the Welty camp on a hot, dry day in September. Airy white tufts floated above the crop, lifted into the clear blue sky. Notices on each cabin and tent advised the folks to be ready to pick at 6 a.m. Elsa dressed in pants and a long-sleeved blouse and made breakfast, then woke the children, who now sat on the edge of their bed, eating hot, sweet polenta, chewing it silently. It broke Elsa's heart that they would be picking with her today, especially Aunt. But they hadn't had a meeting about it, not this season. Last year, they'd been naive. Elsa had thought she could keep her children in school while she made enough money to feed and house and clothe them. Now she knew better. They'd been in the state long enough to understand. Cotton was their lifeblood. Even the children had to pick. They'd had no choice but to fall into the cycle the growers wanted them in, living on credit, building up debt, and never making enough, even with relief, to break out. They had to pick enough to pay off this year's debt so they could start living on credit again in the winter when the work vanished. She rolled up their cotton sacks and filled their canteens and packed their lunches and then hurried the kids out of the cabin to the row of waiting trucks.
"You," the boss said, pointing at Elsa. "Three of you?"
"No," Elsa wanted to say.
"Yes,"
Loretta said.
"The kid's scrawny,"
the boss said, spitting tobacco.
"He's stronger than he looks,"
Loretta said. The boss leaned over to the truck bed beside him and pulled out 3 12-foot-long canvas picking bags.
"Go to the east field. $1.50 apiece for the bags. We'll put them on your account."
$1.50? That's highway robbery,
Elsa said. We have our own bags.
If you live on wealthy land, you use wealthy bags.
He looked at her.
You want the job?
Yes, Elsa said. Cabin 10. He threw them the three long sacks. Elsa and the kids climbed into the truck with the other pickers and were driven 5 miles to another wealthy field, where each was assigned their own row. Elsa unfurled her long, empty bag and strapped it to her shoulder and let it splay out behind her, then showed Aunt how to do it. He looked so small in the row. She and Loretta had spent time explaining the work to him, but he would have to learn as they had, by getting bloody hands.
Quit staring at me like that, Ma, he said. I ain't a baby.
You're my baby, she said. He rolled his eyes. A bell rang to start them off. Elsa stooped over and got to work, reaching into the spiny cotton plant, wincing as the needle-sharp pins stuck deep into her flesh. She pulled off the bowls, separated them from leaves and twigs, and stuffed the white handfuls of cotton into her bag. Don't think about Aunt. Over and over and over she did the same thing. Pick, separate, shove into bag. As the sun rose higher in the sky, Elsa felt her skin burning, felt sweat scrape the sunburn and collect at her collar. Behind her, the bag became heavier and heavier. She dragged it forward with every step. By lunchtime, it was well over 100 degrees in the field. The water truck rolled forward, positioning itself at the end of the rows, which meant they had to walk nearly a mile for a drink of water. Elsa saw how many workers were lined up outside the field hoping for work, standing for hours in the hot, hot sun. Hundreds of them. Desperate enough to take any wage to feed their families. Elsa kept picking, hating with every moment, every breath that her children were out here picking alongside her. When her bag was full, she muscled it out of her row and over to the line at the scales. Loretta came up beside her. They were both red-faced and sweating profusely and breathing hard.
Would it kill them to put in a bathroom?
Loretta said, sopping her brow.
Hush, Elsa said sharply. Look at all the people waiting to take our jobs.
Loretta looked out over the line at the entrance.
Poor folks, even worse off.
A truck rattled up the dirt road, dust clouding up around it. The sides were painted with a white cotton bowl and red, Welty Farms. The truck came to a rattling stop. Mr. Welty climbed out. He was a big man, powerful-looking, with a shock of white hair that looked like cotton tufts beneath his felt fedora. Behind him, in the bed of the truck, were coils of barbed wire. Everyone stopped working, turned.
The owner was heard being passed in whispers among the workers. It's him.
He climbed up onto the platform that held the scales. He looked out over his fields and his workers, then glanced pointedly at the hundreds of people waiting for work.
Thanks to the feds, I had to plant less cotton this year. There is less cotton to pick and more people to pick it. So I'm cutting what we pay by 10%.
10%?
Loretta shouted.
We can't make it.
Elsa clamped a hand over her daughter's mouth. Welty looked directly at Elsa and Loretta.
Anyone want to quit? Take the cut in pay or walk away. I've got 10 men wanting to work for each person here. Doesn't matter to me who picks my cotton.
He paused.
Or who lives in my camp.
Silence.
I thought not, he said. Back to work.
A bell rang. Elsa slowly lowered her hand from Loretta's mouth.
You want to be one of them? She said, cocking her head toward the line of people waiting for work. We are them, Loretta cried. This is wrong. You heard Jack and his friends.
Hush, Elsa hissed.
That's dangerous talk and you know it. I don't care. This is wrong.
Loretta.
Loretta yanked free. I won't be like you, Mom. I won't just take it and pretend it's okay as long as they don't actually kill us. Why aren't you furious?
Loretta.
Sure, Mom.
Tell me to be a nice girl and be quiet and keep working while we go into debt every month at the company store.
Loretta dragged her bag up to the scale and said loudly,
Yes, sir. Pay me less. I'm happy for the job.
The man at the scales handed her a green chit for the cotton, 90 cents for 100 pounds, and the company store would charge her another 10%.
You're awful quiet, Mom said as they walked back to their cabin.
Consider it a blessing, Loretta said. You wouldn't like what I have to say.
Really, Ma,
Aunt said. Don't ask her.
Loretta stopped, turned to her mother.
How is it you aren't as mad as I am?
What good does it do to be mad?
At least it's something.
No, Loretta, it's nothing. You've seen the people pouring into the valley every day. Fewer crops, more workers. Even I understand basic economics.
Loretta threw her empty cotton bag down and ran, dodging this way and that among the cabins and tents. She wanted to keep running until California was only a memory. She was at the farthest reaches of the camp in a thicket of trees when she heard a man say,
Help! When did this darn state ever do anything to help us?
They cut wages again today across the valley.
Now, Ike, be careful. We got jobs and a place here. That's something.
Loretta hid behind a tree to listen to the men gathered in the shadows.
You remember the squatter's camp? We're living better now.
Ike stepped forward. He was a tall, skinny pike of a man with a pale ring of gray hair beneath a pointed bald spot.
You call this living? This is my second cotton season, and I can tell you already that I'll work my ass off, as will my wife and children, and we will end up with about 4 cents left over after our debt is paid. 4 cents! And you know I'm not being sarcastic. Everything we make goes to the store for our cabins and tents, our mattresses, our overpriced food.
You know they're cheating us with their bookkeeping.
They charge 10 cents per dollar for converting our chits into cash, but we can't cash them anywhere else. Every penny we make picking cotton goes to pay our debt at the company store. Ain't no way to get ahead. They make sure we don't ever have money.
I got 7 mouths to feed, Ike,
said a tall man in patched overalls and a straw hat.
Most of us have family dependent on us. We can't do anything. I don't care what this Valen says, it's dangerous to listen to him.
Jack. She should have known he'd somehow be a part of this. He was a doer. Loretta stepped out from behind the tree.
Ike's right. Valen's right. We have to stand up for ourselves. These rich farmers have no right to treat us this way. What would they do if we stopped picking?
The men looked nervously at each other.
Don't talk about a strike. You're just a girl, one man said.
A girl who picked 200 pounds of cotton today,
Loretta said. She held out her hands, which were red and torn.
I say no more. Mr. Valen's right. We need to rise up and...
A hand clamped around Loretta's bicep, squeezed hard.
Sorry, boys, Elsa said. My daughter had a rough day. Don't pay her any mind.
She hauled Loretta back toward their cabin.
Dang it, Mom!
Loretta hollered, yanking free.
Why did you do that?
You get pegged as a union rabble-rouser and we're finished. Who can say there wasn't a grower spy in that group? They're everywhere.
Loretta didn't know how to live with this gnawing anger.
We shouldn't have to live like this.
Mom sighed.
It won't be forever. We'll find a way out.
When it rains, when we get to California, we'll find a way out. New words for an old, never realized hope. Tension began to take up space in the valley. It could be felt in the fields, in the relief lines, around camp. The lowered wages had frightened and unsettled them all. Would it happen again? Nobody was saying the word out loud, but it hung in the air anyway. Strike. At night, in the growers' camps and the ditch bank settlements, field foremen began to show up, clubs in hand. They walked from cabin to cabin and tent to tent and shack to shanty, listening to what was being said, their appearance designed to have a chilling effect on conversation. Everyone knew that there were spies living among them, people who had chosen to stay in the grower's good graces by passing along names of anyone who expressed discontent or stirred up trouble. Now, after a long day spent picking cotton, Loretta was slumped on her bed, watching her mom heat up a can of pork and beans on the hot plate. She heard footsteps outside. A piece of paper slid under the cabin door. No one moved until the footsteps went away. Then, Loretta launched herself off the bed and grabbed the paper before her mother could. "Farm workers unite. A call to action. We must fight for better wages, better living conditions. A coincidence our wages are cut now? We don't think so. Poor, hungry, desperate folks are easier to control. Join us. Break free. The Workers' Alliance wants to help. Join us Thursday at midnight in the back room at the El Centro Hotel." Mom grabbed the paper, read it, crumpled it.
"Don't."
Mom lit a match and set fire to the paper. She dropped it to the concrete floor, where it burned to ash.
"Those people will get us fired and thrown out of this cabin," Mom said.
"They'll save us,"
Loretta argued.
"Don't you see, Loretta?" Mom said. "Those men are dangerous. The farmers are opposing unionization."
"Of course they are. They want to keep us hungry and at their mercy, so we'll work for anything."
"We are at their mercy," Mom cried.
"I'm going to that meeting."
"You are not. Why do you think they're meeting at midnight, Loretta? They're scared. Grown men are scared to be seen with the communists and union organizers."
"You're always talking about my future. Your big dreams for me. College. How do you think I'm going to get there, Mom? By picking cotton in the fall and starving in the winter? By living on the dole?"
Loretta moved forward.
"Think about the women who fought for the vote. They had to be scared, too, but they marched for change, even if it meant going to jail. And now we can vote. Sometimes the end is worth any sacrifice."
"It's a bad idea."
"I can't take being kicked around and treated badly, barely surviving anymore. It's wrong what they're doing. They should be held accountable."
"And you, a 14-year-old girl, are the one to make them pay, are you?"
"No, Jack is."
Mom frowned, tucked her chin in.
"What does Mr. Vallon have to do with this?"
"I'm sure he'll be at the meeting. Nothing scares him."
"I've said all I'm going to say on this subject. We are staying away from union communists."
31. On Thursday, after 10 hours of picking cotton, Loretta's entire body hurt, and tomorrow morning she would have to get up and do it all again, for 10% less in wages. 90 cents for 100 pounds of picked cotton, 80 cents if you counted the cut taken by the crooks at the company store. She thought about it endlessly, obsessively. The injustice of it gnawed at her, just as she thought about the meeting, and her mother's fear. Loretta understood the fear more than her mother suspected. How could Loretta not understand it? She'd lived through the winter in California, been flooded out, lost everything, survived on barely any food, worn shoes that didn't fit. She knew how it felt to go to bed hungry and wake up hungry, how you could try to trick your stomach with water, but it never lasted. She saw her mother measuring beans out for dinner and splitting a single hot dog into 3 portions. She knew Mom regretted every penny she added to their debt at the store. The difference between Loretta and her mother wasn't fear. They shared that. It was fire. Her mother's passion had gone out, or maybe she'd never had any. The only time Loretta had seen genuine anger from her mother was the night they'd buried the Dewey's baby. Loretta wanted to be angry. What had Jack said to her the first day they met? "You have fire in you, kid. Don't let the bastards snuff it out." Something like that. Loretta didn't want to be the kind of woman who suffered in silence, refused to be. Tonight was her chance to prove it. At 11 o'clock, she lay in bed wide awake, waiting, counting every minute that passed. Aunt lay beside her, hogging the covers. Usually, she wrenched them back and maybe even gave him a kick for good measure. Tonight, she didn't bother. She eased out of bed and stepped onto the warm concrete floor. For as long as she lived, she would be grateful for flooring. Always. A quick sideways glance confirmed that her mother was asleep. Loretta grabbed a blouse and her overalls from the coat rack and dressed quickly, buttoning the bib after she'd stepped into her shoes. Outside, the world was still. The air smelled of ripe fruit and fecund earth, a hint of wood smoke from extinguished fires. Nothing ever really left here. Things lingered. Scents, sounds, people. She closed the door quietly behind her, listening for footsteps. Her heart was pounding. She felt afraid and keenly alive. She waited, counted to 10, but she didn't see any foreman out and about. Moving quietly, she headed into the night. In town, she walked past the theater and city hall and turned onto a back street where the grass was overgrown and most of the houses and businesses were boarded up. Dodging the streetlights, she stuck to the shadows until she came to the hotel they'd stayed in during the flood. It was so quiet out here, she hoped they hadn't canceled the meeting. All day, as she'd sweated and strained in the field, dragging her heavy sack behind her, pocketing the coupon that devalued her labor, she thought about tonight's meeting. There were no lights on in the El Centro Hotel, but a few cars were parked out front, and she saw that the heavy chain that locked the doors together hung slack from one of the doorknobs. Loretta cautiously opened the front door. A man with a beak of a nose and small round spectacles stood behind the reception desk, staring at her.
"You need a room?"
he said in a heavily accented voice. Loretta paused. Could she be arrested for just showing up? Or was this man an employee of the big farmers, here to identify rabble-rousers? Or was he a friend of Jack's, here to make sure only the right people made it to the meeting?
"I'm here for the meeting," she said.
"Downstairs."
Loretta moved toward the stairs, nervous suddenly, excited, scared. She touched the smooth wooden banister as she made her way down the narrow stairs, past a broom closet and laundry room. She heard voices, followed the sound to a room in the back, its door open to reveal a crowd inside. People stood shoulder to shoulder, men, women, and a few kids. Bobby Rand waved at her. Jack stood in the front of the room, commanded attention. Although he was dressed like many of the migrants around him, in faded, stained overalls and a frayed denim shirt beneath a dusty brown suit coat, there was vibrancy to him, an aliveness that was like no one she'd ever met before. Jack believed in things and fought to make the world a better place. He was the kind of man a girl could count on.
150 strikers were herded into cages, he was saying in a passionate voice. Cages in America. The big farmers and their corrupt coppers and citizens turned vigilantes put your fellow Americans in cages to break a strike of workers who just wanted an even shake. 2 years ago, a bunch of Tulare farmers shot into a crowd of people just for listening to strike organizers. 2 people were killed.
Why are you telling us this?
Someone yelled. Loretta recognized him from the squatters' camp they'd lived in. A man with 6 kids and a wife who had died of typhoid.
You trying to scare us off?
I'm not going to lie to you good people. Striking against the big farmers is dangerous. They'll oppose us with everything they've got. And folks, as you know, they've got it all. Money, power, the state government.
He picked up a newspaper, held it out for everyone to see. The headline read, Workers' Alliance Un-American.
I'll tell you what's un-American, and that's big farmers getting richer while you get poorer, Jack said.
Yeah,
Jeb said.
What's un-American is cutting pickers' wages just because the growers are greedy.
Yeah,
the crowd yelled back.
They don't want you to organize, but if you don't, you'll starve, just like the pea pickers did in Nipomo last winter. I was there. Children died in the fields, starved, in America. The big growers are planting less because cotton prices are down, so they pay less. God forbid their profit diminishes. They aren't even pretending to give you a living wage.
Ike yelled out, "They think we ain't human!" Jack looked out at the crowd, made eye contact one by one with his audience. Loretta felt an electricity of hope move from him to the crowd.
"They need you. That's your power. Cotton has to be picked while it's dry and before the first frost. What if no one picks it?"
"A strike!" someone called out. "That'll show 'em!"
"It isn't easy," Jack said. "Cotton is spread out over thousands and thousands of acres, and the growers stand together. They pick a price to pay and stick with it. So we need to stand together. Our only chance is to join forces, all of the workers, everyone, everywhere. We need you all to spread the word. We have to shut down the means of production completely."
"Strike!" Loretta yelled.
The crowd joined in, chanting, "Strike, strike, strike." Jack saw Loretta at the same time someone grabbed her arm. Loretta yelped in pain and wrenched free, turning. Her mother stood there, looking angry enough to blow smoke.
"I can't believe you'd do this. Did you hear what he said, Mom?"
"I heard." Mom glanced sideways across the room, saw how many people were here. Jack pushed through the crowd, coming their way.
"Your speech was great," Loretta said as he drew near.
"I noticed you showed up alone," he said. "It's late for a girl your age to be out by herself."
"Would you say that to Joan of Arc?" Loretta said.
"You're Joan of Arc now, are you?" Mom said.
"I want to go on strike, Jack."
"Loretta," Mom said sharply.
"It's Mr. Valen. Now go upstairs and let me speak to him. I'll deal with you later." "You can't make me—"
"Go, Loretta," Jack said evenly. He and Mom stared at each other.
"Okay, but I'm striking," Loretta said.
"Go," Mom said.
Loretta turned away and trudged up the stairs. She didn't care what her mother said. She didn't care how much trouble she got in or how dangerous it was. Sometimes a person had to stand up and say enough was enough.
"How long have you been back in Welty?" Elsa asked Jack when they were alone. "A week or so. I was going to send word to you."
"Oh, I'd say you sent word." She stared at him, wishing that things were different, that she was different, that she had her daughter's fire and courage.
"She's a 14-year-old girl, Jack, who snuck out in the middle of the night and walked a mile to get here. You know what could have happened to her?"
"What does that tell you, Elsa? She cares about this."
"What does that prove? We all know it's wrong, but your solution won't make our lives better. You'll just get us fired, or worse. Our survival hangs by a thread. Do you get that?"
"I get it," he said. "But if you don't stand up, they'll bury you 1 cent at a time. Your daughter understands that."
"She's 14, Elsa said again.
Jack lowered his voice to match hers.
"A 14-year-old who is picking cotton all day. I assume Aunt is too, because it's the only way for you to feed them."
"Are you judging me?"
"Of course not," he said. "But your daughter is old enough to decide for herself about this,"
says the man with no children.
"Elsa, I'm making the decision for her." "You should teach her to stand up for herself, Elsa, not to lie down."
"And now you are definitely judging me. If you thought I was a brave woman, you've misjudged me."
"I don't think so, Elsa. I think you believe it, though, which is tragic."
"Stay away from Loretta, Jack. I mean it. I won't let her be a casualty in this war you're playing at."
"No one is playing, Elsa."
She walked away. He started to follow her.
"Don't,"
she snapped, and kept walking. Outside, she grabbed Loretta's arm and half-dragged her out to the street, where they began walking home in the dark. Automobiles rumbled past them, headlights bright.
"Mom, if you'd listen to him..."
"No," Elsa said, "and neither will you.
It's my job to keep you safe. By God, I failed at everything else. I will not fail at that. Do you hear me?
Loretta stopped. Elsa had no choice but to stop too and turn back.
What?
Do you really think you failed me?
Look at us, walking back to a cabin smaller than our old tool shed, both of us skinny as matchsticks and hungry all of the time. Of course I failed you.
Mom,
Loretta said, moving close.
I'm alive because of you. I go to school. I can think because you want to make sure I always do. You haven't failed me. You've saved me.
Don't you try to turn this around and make it about thinking for yourself and growing up.
But it is about that, Mom, isn't it?
I can't lose you,
Elsa said. And there it was, the truth.
I know, Mom, and I love you, but I need this.
No, Elsa said firmly. No. Now start walking. We have an early wake up.
Mom!
No, Loretta. No.
Loretta woke at 5:30 and had to force herself out of bed. Her hands hurt like the dickens, and she needed about 10 hours of sleep and a good meal. She put on her tattered pants and a shirt with long ripped sleeves and trudged out to get in line at the bathroom. The camp was strangely quiet. People were out and about, of course, but there wasn't much conversation. No one made eye contact for long. A field foreman stood at the chain-link fence, hat drawn low, watching people. She knew there were more spies about, listening for any talk of a strike. She got in line for the bathroom. There were about 10 women in front of her. As she waited, she saw a flash of movement back in the trees. Ike, at the water pump, filling a bucket. Loretta wanted to walk right over to him, but she didn't dare. She finally made it to the front of the line and used the bathroom. She exited from the back door, closing it quietly behind her. She looked around, didn't see anyone loitering or watching. Trying to look casual, she strolled over to the water pump. Ike was still there. He saw her coming and stepped aside. She bent over and washed her hands in the cold water.
We're meeting tonight, Ike said quietly. Midnight. The laundry.
Loretta nodded and dried her hands on her pants. It wasn't until she was halfway back to her cabin that she felt a prickling of awareness along the back of her neck. Someone was watching her, or following her. She stopped, turned suddenly. Mr. Welty stood there in the trees, smoking a cigarette, staring at Loretta.
Come here, missy,
he said. Loretta walked slowly toward him. The way he looked at her through narrowed eyes sent a shiver down her spine.
Yes, sir.
You pick cotton for me?
I do.
Happy for the job?
Loretta forced herself to meet his gaze.
Very.
You hear any of the men talking about a strike?
Men. They always thought everything was about them. But women could stand up for their rights, too. Women could hold picket signs and stop the means of production as well as men.
No, sir. But if I did, I'd remind them what it's like not to have work.
Welty smiled.
Good girl. I like a worker who knows her worth.
Loretta slowly walked back to the cabin, shutting the door firmly behind her, locking it.
What's the matter?
Mom said, looking up.
Welty questioned me.
Don't draw that man's attention, Loretta. What did he ask?
Nothing,
Loretta said, grabbing a pancake from the hot plate.
The trucks just drove up.
5 minutes later, they were all out the door, walking toward the line of trucks parked along the chain-link fence. Quietly, they joined their fellow workers and climbed up into the back of a truck. When the sun rose on the cotton fields, Loretta saw the changes that had been made by the growers overnight. Coils of spiked barbed wire topped the fencing. A half-finished structure stood in the center of the field, a tower of some kind. The clatter and bang of building it rang out.
Men she'd never seen before paced the path between the chain-link fence and the road, carrying shotguns. The place looked like a prison yard. They were readying for a fight. But with guns? It wasn't as if they could shoot people for striking. This was America. Still, a ripple of unease moved through the workers. It was what Welty wanted, the workers to be afraid. The trucks rumbled to a stop. The workers got out.
They're afraid of us, Mom, Loretta said. They know a strike.
Mom elbowed Loretta hard enough to shut her up.